Well, thank you, my dear. Okay, so we will now proceed with the 9/11 and other deep state crimes teleconference for the 28th of February, 2018. Ken Freeland, Cheryl Curtis, co-facilitating, and Craig McKee, secretary. Craig, you want to do the roll?
Sure. I will read who I have. Barton Bruce, Barbara Honegger, John O'Malley, David Cole, James Hufford, Peter Ketchum, Nina Renfrew, Tim Michael, Michael Springman, Cheryl Curtis, Craig McKee, Gordon Ferry, Doug McKenzie, Ken Freeland, Wayne Costi, Lynn Bradbury, and Marie Spike. Did I miss anyone?
Did you get Nita?
I got Nita, yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
I guess we're good.
Well, all righty then. Having done that, we will now ask for approval of the minutes from the previous teleconference circulated by Craig 6 weeks ago. Any objections to approving the minutes? Hearing none, then the minutes are approved, and we'll move on to consideration of tonight's agenda. We've been asked to reverse the order of our two main presentations tonight. Assuming no objections, Gordon Ferry will be the first item, and then we'll move on to Mr. Springman, if that's acceptable to everyone. And any other amendments to the agenda? Anybody else want to add anything? Or
we'll have the regular announcements at the end, right?
As always, yeah.
This is Marie Spike. I came across an article yesterday on 9/11 that I thought would be important about the gold that was.
You want to share that when we get to announcements, Marie?
Would that be sure. I had no idea when you wanted to do that. I will definitely do that.
Yeah. We'll always do that. So,
okay.
Any other changes to the agenda before we proceed? Okay. Well, hearing none, then I guess we're ready to proceed. And I think to do this correctly, we ought to go into lecture mode here. And then unmute Barbara and unmute Doug. I'm sorry, Jordan. And my apologies for the typo in the draft, but it is Gordon Ferry in the draft agenda. So I guess Barbara is ready to go. All right, Barbara, you and Gordon will handle this. So I will leave it to you to take it from here.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. We have a very exciting first segment tonight with Gordon Ferry. I'll be giving you a thumbnail bio background sketch of him in a moment. I just wanted to mention that bringing him to the call is very synchronistic. It's not like I reached out to try to find this witness at the Pittsburgh Pentagon attack. I did not. I was at the JFK conference in Dallas in November with Bonnie Faulkner and Jane Clark, the head of the 9/11 attorneys group, as you all know. And Gordon Ferry is one of the major speakers at JFK conferences around the country. He will be again at a hotel at Dulles Airport on March 9th, 10th, and 11th that I'll be sending the link to, and maybe everybody wants to watch that. It can be live streamed if you can't go. So he is a major expert on the deep state and speaks on the deep state as well as specifics on the JFK assassination at conferences. So he spoke there, and even though I wasn't an invited guest, I wasn't on the program at the JFK conference, when they heard that I was there, they asked me to speak, so I was the only non-agenda person who spoke. And after I spoke about my meeting with Fletcher Prouty, it had to do with my research on my book, October Surprise, after my presentation, Gordon came up to me and with a note in his hand, and he said, "We've got to talk, and we've got to talk now." And so we went out in the hall in a corner and two chairs, and we were like two HAL computers comparing and exchanging information. And that has continued by telephone calls and emails ever since. So that's how I learned about Gordon. I had no idea he existed before. And during my interaction with him, sitting on those chairs in the hall at the JFK conference, he just mentioned that he had been at the Pentagon on 9/11. He was stopped in traffic on I-27 going south, a little bit north of the midline where the helipad is. He was stuck in traffic for, he guesstimates, about an hour, and he saw a very, very important piece of wreckage. And so the first thing he's going to do is tell you about that. I'm going to be asking questions of him to keep him kind of on track because we only have 20 minutes. So, and then we're going to move on to other major areas of his personal knowledge, for instance, about Dove Zakheim, with whom he worked over a period of decades in his positions. So now a short bio. I did send everybody, I believe it was attached to the agenda. It was a kind of specific sub-bio, Gordon, of his interactions over about four decades, I calculate it, with Dov Zakheim, who was, of course, the comptroller, the chief financial officer of the Pentagon before, on, and after 9/11 under Rumsfeld. So that will be the second major item we'll be covering. So now for a brief bio. Gordon has been in the Marines. He's been a pilot. He was trained as a marksman and a sniper. He's therefore very good at estimating distances and ranges, which, as you'll see, will be very important as he guesstimates the distance from his car where he was parked in traffic on I-27 to the major piece of good service. He ran security for national security events with the President of the United States and other VIPs. Worked with the Nuclear Fuels Recovery Program, worked with Israel to protecting their nuclear launch sites, was involved with planning for the Iranian hostage rescue mission. Most importantly, he's been senior management for money center banks, both in the United States and in Italy, financing U.S. international military sales, that is, sales for countries of all major military equipment for the United States. So he quips about himself that he was the military-industrial complex. Now, you may ask yourself why Gordon is coming forward. Like myself, there are a lot of really good people who were very high up on the...
Barbara, I need to interrupt you here for a second. Is anybody else hearing Barbara fade out and fade back in?
Okay, I'll try to hold the... is that better?
Well, I don't know. It's just like periodically it seems like you fade just a bit and then come back in kind of thing.
Okay, that may be because I may be moving the phone. I'll try to be conscious of that. Okay.
Okay.
All right.
Again, the thing about the Israel.
Okay, I'll go back to that. Work with Israel protecting their nuclear launch sites. Worked on planning for the Iranian hostage rescue mission. But most importantly, he's been senior management for money center banks in both the United States and one in Italy, financing United States international military foreign sales. All right, so, and worked with Dov Zakheim at the Pentagon and Bill Schneider at the State Department for many decades in this financing of international U.S. military sales roles. He worked on black projects, including building small secret aircraft, is knowledgeable about drones made of special lightweight composite materials. And so now moving on to the questions. He has three major 9/11-related areas of knowledge. He was a witness at the Pentagon on 9/11, shortly after the attack, stuck in traffic on I-27. That'll be my first series of questions. Number two, he knew and worked with Dov Zakheim for decades. He'll tell us about that and why it matters for the theory at the Pentagon that the plane that, as you know, I believe the evidence shows was destroyed by the helipad was in fact an exercise, remote-controlled exercise plane. And he also had a meeting with the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency in the Air Force right after the 9/11 attack. And if we can get to it at number three, he'll talk about that. So now we're moving on to what I consider to be the most important part of Gordon's testimony, and that is what he witnessed on the lawn at the Pentagon, stuck in traffic, guesstimates for about an hour on I-27. Going south, he was on the lane closest to the northbound lane, that is the southbound I-27 lane closest to the Pentagon, stuck in traffic, looked up a rise to the lawn, and he's going to tell us what he saw. And you should know that he is doing a sworn jurid affidavit on what he's about to tell you. He will be sending that to me, notarizing it, sworn under penalty of perjury if he sent it to a court or a grand jury, and I will be providing that to the list once I receive it. So, Gordon, thank you so much for being here, and could you please tell us what you saw on the lawn of the Pentagon on 9/11, not long after the attack? About how long after the attack, why were you on the road? What did you see, and how do you know that it could not have been from 757? So go ahead, Gordon.
All right. Just for one brief moment, I will take a little side trip here, and I won't do it again tonight. I just want to say, when I met Barbara, I didn't know anything about her background, and she pressed her CD in my hands, but it took 5 more days before I saw it. So my big reaction was when I saw it, because I knew she got it just right and left no wiggle room at all. The other statement, part of the statement I want to make is that, to a great extent, I'm a witness on 9/11. Not just from these events, but going all the way back before the first truck bomb was planted in the World Trade Center. Okay. Now, to answer your question, Barbara, I commuted every day. I had a new position, relatively new, as president of a de novo IT management company in Roslyn, and I had just moved into a penthouse in Crystal City on Eads Avenue. So every morning I would drive around 9 o'clock on 27 North to Roslyn to my office, and then I'd come back the same route both times by the west entrance to the Pentagon. There was no car lane except the northbound lane closer to the helicopter pad than that. So that morning I drove to Roslyn, and everything was normal. I passed the Pentagon, and when I got to the lobby of the high-rise where the office was headquartered, the company was headquartered, there was mayhem in the lobby, and I discovered there was an attack ongoing. And about 10 minutes later, I headed back to rejoin my wife, and I got right into the initial traffic jam, because in that short period of time that I was doing that, the plane or the incident had occurred at the Pentagon had commenced. So I got as far as Barbara very accurately described, just short of the center line on the west side heading southbound on 27, and I couldn't move. In the northbound lane right next to me and almost past me heading north was a fire engine, a hook and ladder, the old type. It's very long and has a driver all the way in the rear with a separate wheel and steering wheel. And he and I were opposite each other, and he was a little north of me. So I had a clear vision of one part of the Pentagon at an angle. To the right, I didn't tell Barbara this, to where the other piece of wreckage was. My vision was obscured by a tree. If I were to draw a straight line between myself and the wreckage, the tree would be there. But I could see something that was only about 50 yards away from me, which was a intact, complete wheel assembly for an aircraft with the landing gear door still intact, and all the wheels and main strut basically intact. You know, obviously it had been thrown or broken off or something anyway and jettisoned, and it was just sitting there. Now, I was a little bit below grade in the car and in the lane, so I couldn't see the helicopter pad in terms of the nice white square rectangle you see in a photograph. I could see the little heliport control tower, but I couldn't see exactly where that was. Now I can, looking at photographs, I can see just about exactly where it was, but not visible to me at the time. I sat there, I'm guessing, an hour, and this would probably have been around 9:20, something like that.
No, it couldn't have been Lord. The attack didn't happen until after 9:30. So that's the.
It was about 10 minutes after I left Roswell, I'd say I got that far. And there were people walking up across on foot with briefcases and what have you. Some walked across the bridge. Nobody walked on water that I saw. And they were heading out. Cars were abandoned, so on. So all I had to look at, basically, was the firemen, the smoke, and that landing gear assembly. Now, I have a background in aviation, so I wasn't a novice looking at it. After that, I continued on. And
a minute, Gordon. Please don't go on. Tell us how many mules were on it, and tell us how you know it couldn't have been a 757 from the door. The fuselage door.
At your request, I took a closer look at all this stuff, and I immediately found that the actual geometry, the shape of the landing gear doors on a 757, and I looked at every airline that flew it, and they're all the same. There wasn't somebody that had a modified aircraft. Are totally different from the landing gear I was looking at, both as to size and then to geometry. Your landing gear doors on a 757 are taller than they are wide when the landing gear is down and they're open and they're pointing straight down. Whereas landing gear assembly that I was looking at not only was only about two-thirds the size, but it had... it was much wider than it was tall.
You're talking about the door now. The door.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so that alone tells me that there's no way that came off of 757.
Right. Now, just for everybody to know, just before the call, by within the hour or so, I sent everybody four photographs. The very first one shows the underside of a 757 with the four-wheel landing gear wheel assembly, the huge strut, and the very tall and not very wide landing gear fuselage door that Gordon is talking about. So you can see, of course, it was on its side on the lawn, but you can see exactly what he saw. Okay, go on,
Gordon. Well, go on to what I answer your question. Do you want me to...
So the other major point about what you saw is you've explained, if I heard you correctly, because you, as you said earlier in your discussion here, that you hadn't mentioned it to me, but now I understand. I had asked you, why do you think that the other main wreckage piece that we're all aware of, that I've sent photographs to the callers as well as yourself, of the kind of crumpled up piece of the fuselage with red, white, and blue paint on it. Why you didn't see that? And you've answered that. There was a tree that was blocking your view, and you've told me that this landing gear wheel assembly with the strut and the door still with it was further to the north or the left on the lawn than that, and that was that other piece was blocked by the tree. Is that correct?
Yes, but the other piece of wreckage that the tree was in the way, I only saw recently. I didn't see it that day. But it's very clear to me that that's not off of a regular aircraft, because in December of 1959, I was part of a group that gathered in all the pieces of an aircraft that had blown up at over 34,000 feet, and we were collecting everything from that aircraft, bodies, body parts, luggage, every part of the fuselage and everything else, working with the FAA and working with the Marine Corps. We had helicopters, guidance, and what have you. And the wreckage from these aircraft is very distinctive. I've seen a lot of crashes since, and that is that the outer skin, if you look at that one piece of wreckage, is very thin, and what should be there and isn't is insulation that's attached to it on a regular commercial aircraft, because they have to go up and be pressurized and all the other things.
So that alone said that it probably didn't come off of the, you know, a regular commercial aircraft.
And this is another very important question, Gordon. I had asked you, what color was any of was the door attached to the wheel assembly, which would be part of the fuselage, what color it was, and what color was it?
Yeah, the door to the landing gear bay was white, whereas the other piece of wreckage was red, white, and blue. But I had also looked, as I said, at all of the airlines and the way that they design their colorations, and they varied. They all had red, white, and blue, but they varied in terms of the various widths. And also, in some cases, they would add another color in addition, like yellow. So the, you know, I just noted what the stripes look like. There was no one consistent way of striping an American Airlines aircraft. It depends on, I don't know what it depends on, but they do it differently. I have photographs of all that.
Right, and I just want to go on the record here for everybody that, to my knowledge, and when we get to the Q's and A's, maybe someone knows otherwise, or knows someone who knows otherwise, or believes they know otherwise, but to my knowledge, I have never seen a photograph of this large four-wheeled landing gear with a strut, and with or without a fuselage door attached, or with it, anywhere in any of the photographs on the Pinbon Lawn. I've never seen it. So I asked you about that, and what was your answer to that?
Well, I had looked at every piece of photography I could find on the Internet, plus what you sent me, and I came back to you and said, where's the engine? I said, the only place it can be is somebody took it away or they put it underneath one of those white tents.
You're talking about the wheel assembly.
They removed it. Yeah.
They removed it somehow or camouflaged it somehow under a tent.
Begging the question of how it got there, of course.
Exactly. Okay. All right. So I think we've pretty much covered. Oh, no, there's one other major thing. Just before this call, when I sent the four photographs, the fourth one that I sent, and Gordon, you have it as well, is the collage. It supports the alleged official story, of course. But there's a collage of a 757 with arrows going to the different parts of the plane with five photographs in frames of parts that the Pentagon claims, the FBI claims, were found somewhere at the Pentagon, inside in the wreckage on the lawn, whatever. They're taken out of context, but they're photographs of five parts, and two of them are two separate, it's claimed, struts, landing gear struts. And you, when you saw that, you made the major point that there wouldn't be three major landing gear struts, the one that you saw on the lawn and those two. So your comment on that?
Well, that's right, unless it's a miracle of physics. The 757s all have two main landing gear struts. That's it. And if you count the two that they show, and what I saw outside, it had to be from different aircraft.
Exactly.
But I would say there's so many other things that you reach the same conclusion. In that particular collage, it would be simple, and I mean simple, for any one of probably 40 engineers at Boeing to identify everything he was looking at as to whether it was or was not off the 757. And yet apparently that's never happened. Well, the whole protocol, and I know it's got to be still standard of the Aeronautics Association, is that you have to collect everything from an aircraft and try and put the aircraft together the importance of finding out what's missing.
Well, they didn't do that for any of the aircraft.
Yeah, and apparently
they didn't do that for any of the 9/11 aircraft at all, on the pretext that it was not under the jurisdiction of the NTSB because it was pre-proclaimed a terrorist attack, and therefore the FBI was in charge.
However, your expertise was so great in this area that you provided actually most of the answers I would need to reach a sound conclusion on circumstantial evidence, yes, but you really have shown what was and wasn't there when we've seen nothing out of the authorities on this at all. But I know, I'll never forget what a debris field looks like. We spent 2 days in freezing weather, up to our chest in water sometimes, getting body parts out and so on. Well, where?
Well, now you're not talking about 9/11. Now you're talking about the previous crash that you investigated.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
So I know it happens.
Well, you know what it's supposed to look like. Yes, correct.
I'm sure as I'll do. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on to the second major area of your personal knowledge that could have a major relationship to 9/11, and that is, if you could tell us what Dove Zakheim told you about when he was about to become or had just become the CEO of SBC Corporation, which specialized in remote control of aircraft, including so-called exercise aircraft that would have to have the capability of being destroyed by some kind of remote signal if it appeared during an exercise that something was going awry and that the exercise craft might strike some kind of civilian target and kill people. So he was about to or had just become the CEO of SBC Corporation. And tell us what he told you and how, first off, how you know Dov Zakheim, how long you've worked with him and in what capacity, and what he told you about SBC Corporation's three major goals, in particular the secret airport.
I started working with Dov Zakheim in the mid-70s, a little, maybe 74. And that went on for, I don't know, maybe, at least 12 years, but that is like three presidential regimes and so on, and also with Schneider. Zakheim I communicated with better than Schneider, but both fairly well. And they were two of a kind. I moved on in my life, he moved on in his life. It turned out a Democrat was elected president. And he was out of office because Dove was a Republican. And he moved on to a new division of SPC that he was chief executive officer of. And I went over to Roslyn. His offices were over there, too, in order to see him. And at that time, I was no longer in banking. And he was telling me about his new job. But in the interim, I helped him find a job, or try to, with Lehman Brothers. I introduced him to, had a luncheon to one of the partners of Lehman Brothers, and I knew how Dove felt about wanting to make money and how he felt upset that he couldn't make money with the wonderful background he had, you know, and working for the government and so on. So I already knew they weren't going to hire him. I never told him that. Anyway, he went on, and this is the job he found. So he told me that he was doing three things, that the company had a technology for what they call flight interruption systems, that they could remotely take over an aircraft against the will of the crew and fly it any way they liked. The second area of technology was in drones. And the third area of technology was that they, highly secret, they were making a secret air facility, obviously associated with these skills. And I didn't think anything about it because I've been involved in all sorts of things for 37 years with the government. And this was, you know, to me, just another black operation of some kind. So when I looked at Barber's material and I saw that it only edified flight interruption systems and drones, I said, what about the secret air facility? Isn't that important? You know?
And I about fell off my chair when I heard that, because that's what you'd need on 9/11. Now, people need to know that just because, I believe this was in the mid-80s when he told you this, well before 9/11, Gordon. People need to understand that just because way back then, Zakheim told Gordon that SBC's subdivision was building a secret airport for its drones and flight interruption systems technology, then that doesn't mean it was just a single airport. It could have, in the interim between then and 9/11, more than one covert airport. So anything else you want to tell us about Zakheim?
Yeah. I had worked for decades with the U.S. government, not as an employee and not even having expenses reimbursed. Never charged for it. And I was absolutely the beating heart of the military-industrial complex. I was invited to all the air shows, not just down in where the public is, up in the top of the chalets with the CEOs, okay, all over the world. And I couldn't buy a meal for myself because I never failed. In 37 years, everything I was tasked with, I did. Why? Because there's some things the U.S. government can't do. I had three sources for these things that I worked on. One was through a chap who worked for both, who's well-known, I'm not going to name right now, for both Zakheim and Schneider and Liaison. So I would be getting tasked by either the Secretary of Defense or the Secretary of State, and they had to be coordinated because you can't get an export license for military equipment without State and Defense approving it, and Congress has to approve it in 30 days or you don't get an export license. So
yeah, let me jump in and just tell people that what you're now talking about is, as a banker, you were assisting the government in financing overseas U.S. military sales, as well as, you've told me, the International Space Station and huge federal projects like that. But go ahead.
Yeah, I was and am the world's leading authority on financing U.S. export security assistance. I'm also the same for any type of international trade. This wasn't all I did. This was one of many things I financed all over the world, in energy and whatever, all of which ends up either in the Aerospace Industries Association or it ends up in the shadow government, which also is largely the ownership of the New York Fed. And
okay,
I know
so back to Zakheim. Back to what this all has to do with Zakheim.
So Zakheim is confided to me in things. Not a lot of things, but some things. And he was negotiating the death of the Lviv fighter in Israel, trying to convince the Israelis that for such a small production run and so on, they should buy F-16s, because the whole world revolved around buying F-16s on the lobbying effort from Boeing and everything else. And I was right in the middle of that, working with Jim Hammond, who was running the F-20 program for Northrop at the time. Anyway, so Doug would tell me how he would go about the business of trying to negotiate with Israel to get them to not build the fighter. The compromise was they bought F-16s, but the cockpit and the avionics were all from the Israelis. On these trips, at least on one occasion or two, I can't remember which, Dove stayed with Eric Sharon in his home. Okay. So I'm aware of the interconnectivity there, and I'm aware of Dove's interconnectivity with both Wolfowitz and with Richard Perle, and how tight those three were. I didn't know about the background that, Barbara, you put into your book, which is, I find, enlightening. I knew Dove was a rabbi. I knew he was a dual citizen. I knew he wouldn't work on Saturday. That's about it. But he was pretty much a clam, and neither one of these two guys ever thought about anybody but themselves. They were not team players, you know. So they'd take my product, and then they'd go do with it what they wanted, and my financial structure, including, you know, special operations, as an example, or just straightforward export of military equipment. On the Iranian hostage rescue mission, as an example, while I was privy to both the classified and unclassified briefings about why it went astray, I was not on any part of that operation. But the things I can't talk about it, we were involved in a similar operation that I was very much involved with out in California. So I moved to another circle, and it's probably the one thing that kept me alive, because the CIA certainly wanted me dead, along with a lot of other people. But I was too valuable to the shadow government, apparently. This I know at the end of the day, after the fact. I wasn't aware of it the whole time. It only dawned on me what was going on.
Okay. So you've given us a good overview of your relationship with Dov Zakheim, how tight he was, a dual U.S. Israeli citizen, observant Jew, tight with Ariel Sharon's at his home, et cetera, working on covert ops, working on the avionics and cockpit for the F-16s that the United States, you assisted the United States sell to Israel, and they put their own avionics and cockpit in it. So let's move on. Do we have time? Maybe there's one other major area that Gordon can cover if there's time. Could we find out from Cheryl or Ken?
Let me check with Michael Spring. And Michael, will you be okay if we spend another few minutes on this topic before we take up yours? Oh, wait a minute. I'm sorry. I have to unmute Michael. He's muted.
And don't forget, there will be Q's and A's on this section, too. So I'm proposing another 5 minutes on this plus 10-minute Q's and A's, or another 15 if Mike's okay with that.
I don't see Michael Stern and I'm...
I don't see Mike either. No, I don't.
Oh, somebody needs to give him a buzz.
I'll go
offline.
But you
said he was on the call earlier, right?
I found later that he had sent me an email about asking for the phone number, but I understood by that point that he was already on the call. So
He was on the call originally, but at the very outset, when I first saw him, I understood he had some trouble getting on the call. So maybe he's having difficulty.
Okay, well,
I'll call him and see what's going on.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Okay.
Thank you, Cheryl. Okay, so 5 more minutes on this at least, and then we'll go to Q&A. Go ahead.
Okay, all right. So there are actually 2 other major areas, Gordon, that maybe we have 2 minutes on one and 2 minutes on the other. So you got to have to keep it brief. And by the way, I highly recommend that we have Gordon back to talk about his in-depth knowledge of the deep state in general in a future.
Well, yeah, if Cheryl's unsuccessful in getting Michael, we'll have more time tonight, okay?
Well, that's true. I hope we can. All right. So the 2 other main areas that are 9-1-1 related, right after, I believe, the day of or the next day, Gordon will let us know, he met with the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency in the Air Force in a direct response to what he understood, i.e. official story at the time, had just happened at the Pentagon and the World Trade Center and such on 9/11. So that's the first. He can tell us about that meeting. And I did send to Cheryl, and I understand it was attached to the agenda, the call, Gordon's statement about that. It's a 2-long paragraph, so people can read it, and that may give more detail than we can go into. And the last part, the fourth, would be, Gordon, if you could tell us briefly your involvement with after the 1993 World Trade Center 1 attack. So maybe let's do that first. What was your involvement after the World Trade Center 1 attack in 1993, Gordon?
Well, my involvement started before the truck bomb attack on the World Trade Center.
Oh, okay.
I had officially warned the government that the World Trade Center and the Pentagon would be hit, and I got their security increase. But I'll talk about it another time if you like. Anyway.
Well, based on what did you warn them? What was your information?
I was getting briefed by the FBI, I'd say, or the CIA, once every 3 months on terrorist activities all over the world, because I had an organization that was out all over the world. And back then, we were worried about the Bader-Meinhof gang and this and that, and kneecapping and so on. And I said, look, I need a briefing on the United States. We're going to have terrorist attacks here. Oh, we've never had a terrorist attack in the United States. I said, Look, I go to Italy. I go to bed at night. There are two bombs go off. They like the Italians. They hate us. What do you mean they're not going to attack us? They're going to attack us. Yeah. So they told me the security they had on the World Trade Center. And I made such a stink about it because I had investigated the World Trade Center twice, once for Marine Midland Bank, New York, at 140 Broadway, once for the largest bank in New Jersey, National State Bank in New Jersey, for occupancy. Both times I said, never in your life go in that building. You can't get
Yeah, tell us water. Why. Tell us why the 40th floor was so important for water.
You can't get water above the 40th floor because there's no pump in the world powerful enough to pump it up higher than that. You can't put reservoirs there. They explain the architecture of the building. The exterior wall is a support. I know demolitions and explosives. I knew that in the Marine Corps, so on and so forth. They put 40,000 gallons of raw sewage in the Hudson River every day, untreated. And this was a Rockefeller-owned building. They had to put...
Just to be, before you go on, what you've explained to me is that obviously there was water on all of the floors up to 110 because they had bathrooms, et cetera. But what you're saying is there wasn't a way to get enough water above the 40th floor for the fire, for the pressure on the fire hoses.
And not only that, but the thermal effect of the fire above that would make it impossible for helicopter operations for rescue because of the winds and the fire and smoke and everything else. Wouldn't work. And nobody could go up the roof to get rescued. So it was,
Just a minute. Just the record, the helicopters did come in and rescue people at the world after the World Trade Center attack in 1993. They were ordered away on 9/11. From rescuing from the roof. But people couldn't get to the roof anyway because the roof doors were locked.
Of course. And what I'm talking about would have happened. That was the best judgment back then. So from two retired police officers walking around in daylight hours, they increased that to eight to pacify me. And they told me they had found these people in Jersey City who had explosives. And by the way, I have the complete formulation of the bomb they tried to. And it would have worked if they had just parked the truck in a different place. And that's why they
And by the way, I want to jump in here, Gordon, because it's very important something you told me. You actually went in and looked in the B2 level of the basement, in the base of the World Trade Center after the 93 attack in World Trade Center 1. And if I recall correctly, you told me that there were a number of columns that were knocked out, not just column B2.
No, I didn't talk to you about columns, except for one thing. I talked to you about how far apart, I don't want to use the term columns, the external steel structure of the World Trade Tower, each one of them, supported it. It was the main supporting member, not the core of the building.
I'm asking you what you saw in the basement of the World Trade Center in the B2 level after the 1993 attack. What did you see in terms of destruction?
No, I didn't go down there. I talked to the people who were involved for the city of New York and what occurred there.
Okay. So what did they say?
Their absolute conclusion, there wasn't any dispute on it, was that the bomb was powerful enough to bring that tower down if they had simply put it in a different place. I don't know if they, I don't remember after last time if they drove it up to the core or where they parked it and what have you. I never went down there.
They parked it by a single column on the B2 level of six levels of the basement.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what did you have an involvement after the 1993 World Trade Center attack?
Aside from having investigated the building twice and watched them build it in front of my window to my office, which I did. And I had clients that were there, so I'd go over there periodically to visit them and what have you. I didn't have another involvement with them. I'm not sure what you're looking for.
Okay, that's fine. I'm learning things on this call I didn't know before. Okay, so let's move on to the last area that I'm aware of your involvement with 9/11, the aftermath, immediate aftermath, and that is, tell us about your meeting with the directors of the DIA and Air Force, why that's important and what that was about right after the attacks of the Pentagon.
It's very important. I had a briefcase communicator that I could use any place in the world, and it worked all the time. Okay. And we lost telephone service in D.C. for about 4 days, I think, as it was, before the telephone started working again. And the first telephone call I got was from outside the United States. And a voice said, we're very sorry. What happened? Are you and your family safe and so on? I said, yes. And he says, do you know who this is? And I said, yes. And he says, do you know why I'm calling? And I said, yes, I think I do. And he said, could you represent us? And I said, yes, I can. I said, call me back this time tomorrow. Now, at this point, I was simply had the Novo management company. And I can't go into more detail about it than that. Suffice to say that we contacted the retired Secretary of the Navy. He got us an appointment with the head of Air Force Intelligence the next day. The Pentagon was totally closed down. There's still smoke in the corridors and everything else. And we got an appointment to another Trapp and I to go there. I think it was 2 in the afternoon or 1 in the afternoon, something like that. And, there, of course, there were guys with broken noses and some machine guns running around. They were putting up missile sites and they had armored cars there. And we waited like an hour and a half before somebody came to the door that we were told to go to. And a very senior Air Force NCO answers, opens the door for us, and he guides us to the commanding general of Air Force Intelligence. Why him? Because he is also the executive officer of the Defense Intelligence Agency. He's also, of course, the Air Force Intelligence Agency. That's all of our satellites. So, all right. Go ahead. Wait, Doc. Testing? Did we lose transmission?
No, I don't think so. You might be testing something to see if Mike Springman's back on the call. I don't know.
Anyway, I gave a off-the-top-of-my-head presentation. 15 minutes into it, he said, you've got just what we're looking for. And I said, I thought so. And he said, wait a minute. And then he walked us down to Vice Admiral Wilson's office, the director, and his chief technologist, and he said the same thing about 20 minutes into the conversation. So I have to assume the Air Force is smarter than he was. Anyway.
Testing.
Testing. He then called George Shannon, the director of the CIA. The three of them took my proposal to the Joint Intelligence Committee at 5:30. Unanimously approved.
Can anybody hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
And at that point, something I worked on for the next several months relating to this that brought me into contact with DARPA and with Admiral Poindexter, which ultimately caused me to go to Vice Admiral Wilson and tell him I was walking away from this thing. And that Poindexter was a crook and that I wasn't going to do, you know, the things that he wanted people to do, and that's it. I also had meetings with, on his first day in office, of the head of the newly formed Joint Counterterrorism Task Force, also with a number of important agencies I won't name. So,
can you just, we need to wrap up here, Gordon.
It's all related to 9/11.
Right. Can you tell us anything about what you were proposing, anything at all? Number two, in this discussion, you mentioned that when you first went back to the Pentagon for these briefings and meetings, you mentioned a missile site. What were you referring to? Were there defensive missiles around the Pentagon we don't know about? And if so, where were they?
No, it was mobile, one of our early technologies, a mobile system like, you'd be familiar with the Rapier system, which was a newer one, and this was maybe the Hawk missile system or something, I don't know which one it was.
And there was, on the outside of the Pentagon,
obviously. The walls of the Pentagon, the one I saw was just up on a little knoll on the south side of the Pentagon. There was an armored car with an M16 machine gun down on the road closest to the Pentagon, just to the on the east side of the Pentagon, facing D.C. Very tough armed men walking around, so on and so forth.
Yeah, okay.
So that's where I actually, when I passed the Pentagon when it was on fire, people were driving so crazily that and having accidents that I got out of the car and I started directing traffic to keep people from killing themselves, and people started yelling thanks and honking at me.
Okay, now I have to ask a question because we need to go to Q&A. Can you tell us anything about, these very high-level meetings immediately after 9/11? How many days approximately after 9/11 did you get the call and have these briefings to the Pentagon? And what can you tell us about what we're proposing?
Well, just find out how long the phone's from D.C., and I got a call, and as soon as they opened up, the next day, Sunday, let's say it's 5 days, I don't know what it is, but anyway, that's Sunday, because I had to get my other associate off the golf course. He was retired. I said, you're not retired now, and he was retiring. And so that was the timetable for that. I was actually working on what I can't talk about for, I would say, 4 months, 5 months, something like that.
Okay, but you tell us it was definitely 9/11 related.
Totally, 100%.
Mm-hmm. All right. Okay, well, thank you, Gordon. We're going to go to the news and A's.
Let me clarify one thing.
Okay.
I was working for California Microwave, which is a prime supplier of the U.S. government. And on the black project we're working with, we work with Israelis on protecting their launch sites. And through that, they trust me as agrees that I knew what their targeting arrangements were. Okay, I was that close to them. And they saved my life in Brazil, and their top guys keep tabs on me on my life. So, that's it.
Okay, thank you so much.
I'm going to guess that there are quite a few folks that have a comment or a question, so we will go into our Q&A mode. And
okay, so Ken, everyone is muted right now.
I just unmuted myself, Cheryl, but I think everybody else is still
muted. Ken, everyone else I think is muted. All right, so I think it's fully.
Yeah, everyone should be muted except ourselves and Barbara and Gordon. Okay.
Okay.
So, star six, if you want to ask a question, you get into to ask a question and or make a comment. And the first one in the queue is Lynn Bradley. Go ahead, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if Gordon mentioned the secret air field or if Barbara did in her prior description, but it made me think of what Philip Marshall was writing about. I just wonder if anyone thought of that. Or if Gordon did. I'll hang up.
Gordon may not know about that, but that's secret. The airfield that Philip Marshall wrote about is not secret. The Marana Pinal Airport, it's not secret. It's just there was a lot of secret activity going on at it. It's a very different thing.
Okay. Thank you. And next to ask the question is Wayne Foster. Wayne Costi.
Yeah, thanks, Gordon, for your observations. I've been looking at the Pentagon for quite some time and familiar with lots of photographs. I have not seen anything at all that looks like what you've described, but I have seen another large piece that is potentially from a distance that would look like that. And I sent it off to our list, our Yahoo Groups list. It is to the north of the Heliport Tower, and kind of just in front of it, it starts off in the shadows. There's a photo, classic photo of people, five officers running by it. And it has some things sticking up that from a distance may have looked like landing gear. But I've sent this around, and hopefully it'll get forwarded to you. So it's really not so much I'm trying to help you, because I think you said that you haven't seen any picture of it. I'm showing you what I found that may be useful. Over.
Wait, Wayne, I don't have that. Did you send the 9/11 list?
Yes, just months ago. So, and I see that it appears in my, on the forum now, so may not have gone through the email systems yet, but it's one of the classic pictures of with a large piece of debris in it. I found out where it's located, and
okay, could you send that to me directly, Gordon?
Yes.
Thank you.
Is there a question in there somewhere?
No. There was not a question. Unless you can. I just want to say something about it, because I looked at all these photos. I think I heard you in the prior email chains or something say that you looked and you haven't seen it. And so I'm just confirming it. The only thing I've seen that kind of fits the description, but only seen from a distance, is this piece that I've I'll send it to Barbara directly. Over.
This is the four very large wheels.
No, it does not.
All right.
It does have two strands that are sticking up. And like I said, it's the only large piece besides the one that is photographed by many of the people. So that's all.
Okay. Well, it's almost certainly. Let's ask a question. Do you have any question in your mind that you were looking at very large wheels?
There is no question in my mind that what I was looking at was no part of 757. I was expecting and looking at photographs to find it. That's why I kept going on the internet. Everything I get my hands on, tons of photographs plus the ones that Barbara provided. And I said, well, where's the wheels? And I certainly know the difference between, your main landing gear and the nose gear, what have you. So definitely what I was looking at was that. If you were to show me something that turned out to be that and you found it over in the corner of a picture, that still doesn't solve the problem. It's not a 757 landing gear.
Right, and I should mention that in my discussions with Gordon, I raised the astonishing fact that at least I'm not, and we've just heard that Wayne is not, except it's one possibility that does it for large wheels. In any case, I'm not aware of any.
It actually is very clearly a piece of the fuselage. It must be stopped for that.
Okay. Have you seen the photo?
I just looked at it. This is clearly a piece of fuselage.
It's just a piece of fuselage, So I just want to go on record when I talked to Gordon about this. I said, Gordon, there isn't a single photo of this anywhere. Why do you think? Have you ever seen a photograph? And his answer to me was words to the effect, well, I just looked at all those hundreds of people who were in traffic along with me to saw it. He said, there are hundreds of witnesses to this thing. It was so hard. But we're not aware of any of them, Gordon.
But apparently it wasn't there very long, because there were some very clear photographs, many of that spot with nothing there. So after I moved along, somebody was in a big hurry to get rid of it.
How heavy do you think this piece would have been? Four wheels, you know, how big of an effort would it have been to move? You know, you don't put it up, pick it up and put it in your pocket. So I'm trying to figure out how it could have been there, and I just can't imagine it. I've looked at as many photos as I can find on of the Pentagon debris, and I don't see any of it.
I'd like to ask that same question, Gordon. How many men do you think it would take to carry that piece away?
They couldn't. No. It's equipment. But there's equipment all over the place, and there are little tents all
right.
over the place. Yeah. And
okay.
people who did this, who I know well, okay, the firm not government, I'm talking about the government, the federal government, they do this all the time. They love false flag attacks, all going back to the 50s. They have a footprint that is so identifiable that in many cases, I'm talking about the CIA specifically, okay? They always include for the FBI, though. They work together. They know they control the media. They know they control everything. And therefore, they're sloppy. They're sloppy as hell.
Let me and remind people. I only just a second put the possibility together. But they're very well photographed. If I see at least six men carrying a tarp over it.
Yeah, that's why I was asking the question, Barbara. That's why I was asking the question, because I was wondering if maybe that's what was underneath the tarp. But I was thinking men could carry this on a structure kind of thing.
I doubtful, but maybe because in the land gear has to be the single strongest piece of steel in an aircraft. It takes the most kinetic energy into
yeah.
it, and at the same time, it's not a small piece of gear, and steel is heavy as hell if you've ever tried to lift it. I think they need. But there was plenty of equipment around to do that. I mean, all you needed is a winch, for Christ's sake. You could drag it under a tent and pull it when night fell. Then you had the hoses, the way they're pointing those hoses. Ask a fireman, you know, was it they had the hoses on? Or were they set up there to mask, you know, so you wouldn't see things in daylight hours? I don't know. All the investigating remains to be done because, as I'm concerned, it hasn't been done any more than it was done on the Kennedy assassination. Or, and certainly in Bobby Kennedy's assassination, he may have both committed suicide. Okay. Same people killed him.
Yeah, by the way, everybody needs to look at the third photograph that I sent just before the call. And it's a captain narrowly kicking the tire, one of the little tires in this very wheel assembly were from 77. And the wheel doesn't even come to weight. So,
you're fading in and out a little. If you could try doing before.
Okay. The third photograph that I sent just before the call is of a captain, man standing in his uniform, a pilot, kicking the tire of the 757 four-wheel steel assembly with the attached door and strap. The wheel doesn't even come up to his feet. So, you know, six. Yes.
Now, that's but again, all you needed is one engineer from Boeing, and all these questions could have been answered in either.
Right. Well, Boeing won't.
I knew all of these companies well. I financed aircraft all over the world, military and civilian. A lot of C-130s and what have you, always with innovative financing. And treasurer of Boeing was a personal friend of mine, Jack Pearson. He and I, at the annual meetings of AIA, where I was always not keynote speaker, but one of the top speakers, for 3 years, he and I had a running debate for gratification on aircraft residuals. In the final one at the Palmer House in Boston, Jack and I had breakfast. I said, Jack, I'm going to have to come ask again. Aircraft residuals are going to go down. And I don't worry about it. So we got up there, it was one mic. We kept shoving it back and forth. And he said, "Now you go first." And I gave my usual spiel how aircraft residuals were ridiculous and Boeing pushed them to an artificial high that couldn't be sustained. And then back to the mic from me, he said, "I agree," and he retired from Boeing. And 4 months later, aircraft residuals collapsed worldwide. That's why.
Ken, I have a question, and I don't know if we're ready for that yet, but I'm not going to do the star six because I'm muted.
Yeah, I'm the same, Ken, as Craig. I also will need to be manual.
So then Craig, okay. Go ahead,
okay.
Cheryl.
So I actually have two questions, but I'll make them quick. So in the circles that you were hanging out in, you know, in the shadow government and in these, you know, different military organizations and businesses, do they all get that 9/11 was a false flag? Are there people there who really believe the official story, or what's your sense?
I don't know anybody who really has their head on straight who, you know, is wet on any of this doubt. You know, in the beliefs of all these things are going on all of us. I know that we've got some big problems now.
Okay. And so looking at maybe the Mandalay Bay thing and then the Parkland school thing, are those have all the signs for false flags, would you say? Or some kind of an orchestrated event?
We have a situation where there, you need to know there are two cultures. Every organization has its own culture. The military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about has its culture, and it's not capable of doing these things. In other words, it would run against the culture. These are men who have been in the military, who've served their countries. I'm talking, this is generalization, there are always exceptions. Mm-hmm. But they are very loyal, and they wouldn't conceive of assassinating Kennedy as an example, whether they liked him or not. I didn't like him. I spent my life trying to nail whoever did, and I finally did. So that's different. But the shadow government's a whole different ballgame, whole different genesis. And their dirty work has been mainly done on our side of the pond by the CIA. It's absolutely true that Rockefeller and John J. McCloy were the real architects for the side of the Bill of Burgers and all that. The Rothschilds were in charge on the other side of the pond. Soros works for them. So the Israel Air Force's connections are with the Rothschilds, not with the U.S. After the death of Rockefeller and John J. McCloy, the power shifted, started the money in the water was going on with the common market and all that. That's all shadow government stuff. Shadow government is not the United States. It's global. It has been from day one. They got started with the OSS. I know all the details of it. And like I say, I know some of the families. I know the Warburg family. I know the Shipley family. I know this family. I know that family. The Warburgs were Bird Pinkus as an example. Elliot Janeway, who I got to talk, he was his son, Liz, is a friend of mine, Bill, is now the honorary vice chairman of Warburg Pincus. And Timothy Geithner, the first job he got as a little payoff for him, was to run over and become president of Warburg Pincus. There are payoffs all over the place. Ownership shares from the Fed. Alan Dulles and Dr. Foster Dulles got shares in the New York Fed for their contribution to all the shifts in the world. So as a coordinator, you've got it. But is it done in the organized way people think about things? No. It's simply done by influence, by people who suggest, and people who are more than willing to prostitute themselves to go out and forget about anything. And I could keep
well, now, Gordon, let me jump in here and play out this. It's very important, your distinction between the MIC, the military complex, meaning the active duty military, the brass, versus the shadow government. However, for 9/11, there had to be, especially at the Pentagon, military brass at the top, or at a very, well, we already know, the top level political appointees who were, you know, Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and Feist and, you know, Pearl and these people, they're political appointees. They're over the military breath. So would you be willing to stipulate that these high-level political appointees over the military breath, over the MIC, could very well be, are, in some critical cases like 9/11, part of an operator for the federal government?
This changes over time, depending on who ends up in office. They determine the most who does, and they have their people all around them, okay? And I can name names all night long. Wesley Clark, wasn't that the guy who gave a speech and said it was a policy coup? He couldn't have been more right. He couldn't have been more right. He was a jock. It's not something he would have supported. But I can tell you, every single member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff with the Kennedy assassination, with the exception of Taylor, were on board. They wanted him killed. And JFK actually taped them talking about a first strike attack with a false flag attack on two U.S. citizens of Russia. And when Kennedy gave tape recordings of those Russians, that's, if you know what Operation Zipper is, that's what triggered the charges that they dummied up to justify a coup d'etat and the necessity to tell him there wasn't time to simply take them, you know, down with in court or whatever. So at that time, and the members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff were notorious for how extreme right they were. And how,
well, that's the point, Gordon. You're talking about chairman of the Joint Chiefs down both for that operation against Kennedy. They were on board for killing him. The MIC.
Yes. But that wouldn't be true today.
Why do you separate the MIC from the shadow government in cases like this?
No, I'm saying that there was, you know, the short list was with people who weren't involved in getting him killed. Everybody wanted him dead. When he was killed, my father told me he was dead. I said, who got to him first? You know, everybody had to have him dead. And that's why a year ago, I stormed the gates with the FBI and the Secret Service getting Trump security, because there are even more people that have to have him dead. And it's going to be Kennedy all over again unless they did certain things. So I recommend that they're doing certain things, but I won't say this. I did. But I have reason to believe that they've done those things. I guess great minds work twice. So these things have been there. They continue to go along, but they don't keep the same shape and form because of eventually changing.
Okay. I think the bottom line of what you're telling is that select individuals in the industrial complex, in the Pentagon, military staff, Joint Chiefs of Staff, even Chairman of the Chiefs of Staff, Operation Northwoods, Kennedy assassination, 9/11, they are involved, but select individuals.
Well, I have documentation that identifies that and proves it. And in addition to that, one of the two key planners, James Angleton was one, and one other guy, did the day-to-day planning in the CIA for it, and they kept records. I've got copies of the records, and I know some of the people and institutions that were part of it. Inter Army.
What?
Sorry?
The JFK assassination you're talking about?
What records are you referring to that you kept?
A notation of a meeting on the assassination plan for Kennedy that were taken during 1963, starting in March through November, naming who was at the meeting, what the topic was, you name it. So the second guy went out and published a book called Regicide. Anybody ever heard of it?
I have that book, yeah.
You'll find documentation there. Well, I know Sam Cummings. I knew him. He's dead now. And I've been all through his warehouses. He was absolutely a CIA asset for doing all things, which they're saying here in some of these meetings, he was present to participate in some way. I also knew his daughter who murdered an Argentine polo player. The neighbor of mine up in northern New Jersey in horse country. So I could authenticate a lot of it in there, and there's very cooperative evidence. There were people who, Elliot Janeway was meeting with that summer, who were money managers, and he was saying how terrible it would be if Kennedy were to continue his programs, and how fortunate it would be if he were not to do that, and Kennedy would be president. And Elliot hated the Kennedys, obviously he hated them. Well, he scared the crap out of these people, and they documented it. And some of the people in our group have that documentation. I have copies of it. And I heard of him firsthand, you know, in terms of how much he hated me. He didn't tell me anything about this or anything else. And so I really braced him before he died. And I had the closest relationship to him, actually, more than his sons did. And he talked. He was the most knowledgeable and informed human being I've ever met. Advisor to every Democrat. Sorry?
Oh, you're breaking up pretty badly, Barb. You're breaking up pretty badly. We can't hear you.
Who are you referring to, most the knowledgeable person? You talking about Janeway?
Elliot Janeway, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Maybe we could do another call on just your... If we could do another call just on that topic, that would be probably worthwhile. But in the meantime, I think Craig has a question for this evening's topic. So go ahead, Craig.
Yeah, there's so many things I'd love to ask, but I'm gonna just stick to a couple of clarifications on the Pentecost subject. Some of my questions were already answered in other questions, but I'm curious. I'm still trying to picture through your description where this part was that you saw. Like, I know you mentioned your view was blocked by a tree. There were trees that look from an aerial view. There were two trees that kind of the path straight to the heliport from the highway. So I just wondered where, if you could help me to understand where in relation to other landmarks that you saw this thing, and then I do have a second question sort of related.
I gave Barb or several diagrams of that. She can provide them to you.
Oh, fantastic. Okay.
You know, those were already attached to the agenda, Craig. Yes, an aerial photograph. Now, of course, this is Gordon's best guesstimate. But those two, the attachments, as I understand it, I never got the agenda, but I'm told by Cheryl that the attachment was what I again put on the agenda. And that is an aerial photograph where I sent it to Gordon and asked him to put in that in the approximate guesstimated location where he saw the wheel assembly. And he's done that, and you should be able to see that clearly. And this is pretty close to the one large piece of fuselage with the paint on it that we know about, which is a bit further to the left right than the piece that he saw. And Ben's car was north of the boat. So he was looking at it, the piece, the wheel assembly, at a diagonal angle up the slight right.
Okay. I would just make the comment that I think when we refer to these pieces of fuselage as large, I think that's perhaps the wrong description. Because large if you compare them to a telephone, but they're not large when you're talking about airplane wreckage. So I would.
Well, what I meant was the large we knew about.
We knew about
to date. Yeah.
Yes, indeed, you're right. And my question, I was interested in the fact that you. Gordon, you were in traffic on Southbound 37 for so long. When we see the photograph of Lloyd England's taxi that was supposedly hit by pole that was allegedly hit by the plane, we see no cars at all on the road. And I wonder whether you have any insight into how it happened that all the other cars were removed from the road, or how they all left out of there, and we were only left being able to see the cab with a great distance of no cars behind it. I believe he was also on found 20,000. Is that something you can shed some light on?
No, I can only tell you what I saw and what happened to me. After I sat, and I didn't time it. I'm estimating that I was out there an hour, something like that, instead of my 10 minutes. The traffic started to slowly move, which obviously was getting out at the other end of the hose into Crystal City, Pentagon City, Route 1 South, whatever. And our penthouse was only about, I'd estimate, 1,000 yards or even 900 yards away from the crash scene. In fact, we had smoke from the Pentagon, you know, coming over our balcony and stuff. In fact, we had SWAT people running up and down the walls of our building. They're checking all the cars, seeing if there were bombs on and so on. And that was the point I got out of the car and started directing traffic right at that corner of Eads and whatever it was that's past us. One car went right through the intersection sideways through the hedge and inside an apartment building. That's how panicked some people were. So everybody's ignoring the traffic signals and everything else. So
Craig,
I don't believe that Gordon knows the burning of England.
No, I was indoors after that, so I don't know how long the traffic persisted.
Right, but what I guess I'm trying to do is compare your experience to what we've heard about. In other words, England's cab was supposed to have been hit when he was not stopped in traffic, when he was allegedly hit, because he had time to swerve all over the road and then come to a stop, allegedly. So I'm just trying to split that in comparison to, you know, when you were there, what period you were there, and do these two match up, is what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, what is England's cab on the going north to south? I'm just reminding.
No.
It wouldn't matter because it really is. It's the timing is set for first responders when equipment was arriving. When that dissipated, they were better organized, and who knows? I don't know the timing after that.
Mm-hmm.
For that, I was focused on finding wife.
Right. Okay.
And that's another general comment. Nobody was looking at this critically the way we are now at the time. Everybody only had one thought. Is there another hit coming? What's going to happen next, now, 5 minutes from now? There's a jet circling around with its flaps down, pulling load of ordnance, you know. That's what you were thinking about. You weren't thinking, what's a piece of wreckage, you know, anything else. I looked at this because I had no choice. I was just sitting there staring at it.
Right.
I asked Gordon, and he said he would do it from your affidavit. And I'm going to ask him to do a sketch of what he saw and, you know, the direction from which he saw it, what was in the background, like the, you know, the helipad air traffic controllers lookout. He can see that. So hopefully we'll have a sketch with the sworn jurid affidavit.
Let me make one last comment, if I may. September of 1962 till September of 63 in Marine Corps Intelligence, working on Cuba. Okay, and that happened to be the same time frame that the CIA politically took control of the intelligence community and put it under its thumb. And we were well aware of it at the time. And a lot of resentment there. I have never agreed to work with the CIA at all. But I have, in many cases, seen where they've operated illegally in the United States and outside of the United States. People who resisted it the most, and that means today and it means during 9/11, tended to be the Office of Naval Intelligence and the Defense Intelligence Agency. Because they didn't want to be under the thumb of the CIA, and they knew they were crooked, and they're crooked today. Okay, and they have a modus operandi like you wouldn't believe.
What years were you talking about when this takeover took place?
1962, September.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And
okay.
I was in Marine Corps Intelligence at that time.
Okay, thank you. Barbara, you want to wrap up it, and then we'll go into announcements?
Okay, do we have Mike Spring on or not?
Mike is on.
No,
I don't
believe so. Cheryl's not even on at the moment.
You can't hear me?
Yes, I can hear Cheryl.
Oh, I can hear Cheryl, but I don't see you on the sign.
Yeah, I'm here. Yeah. Anyway, Mike is coming in via Skype, and that's why we don't see him, so we have to unmute everyone so he can speak.
Okay, well, let me just wrap up real quick, and we'll go to Mike. That's great news. Okay, so I just want to remind everybody, this is a really important new piece of information. We have to take it very seriously, especially if it's going to be a form jury affidavit. And by the way, Gordon, you told me that you would be happy for anybody who has follow-up questions to get in touch with you by phone or email, so why don't you give that out if you'd like to.
Yeah, well, let me just give you my email address, Ferry, F-E-R-R-I-E, at live, L-I-V-E, .com.
Great.
All right.
All right.
Well,
great. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Barbara, and thank you, Gordon, for a really riveting presentation and some real food for thought for the 9/11 Truth Movement, to be sure. Okay, so let's unmute everybody here as we need to do, apparently. And let us welcome Michael Springman back to our teleconference. And Cheryl, you take it away, okay?
I think can you hear me? Yes, we can hear you.
Yes.
Okay. Craig was going to introduce him.
Yeah.
Oh, Craig. Okay, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Gaines is a whistleblower who worked for the U.S. State Department as a diplomat, and in particular served as a visa officer in the U.S. consulate in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, I believe in the late 1980s. And while he was there, he was forced to issue visas to persons hired clandestinely by the CIA to become trained in the USA terrorists. And this he chronicles in his book, Visas for Al-Qaeda, CIA, and That's What Rocked the World. I'm just going to read a couple of sentences from a passage of the book, just to give you an idea of sort of where it's coming from. He writes, this wasn't an ad hoc operation conceived and carried out in response to a specific foreign policy issue. Rather, it was another of too many CIA efforts to destroy governments, countries, and politicians disfavored by the American establishment. And it's bipartisan, in quotes, approach to matters abroad. And I'm jumping a couple of sentences. Along the way, agency-sponsored murders, war crimes, and human rights violations proved to be business. Jobs for the clandestine service, people recruit and run buys, sales of weapons and aircraft, as well as myriad items needed to control banks, countries, and peoples, all provided income and benefits to American countries. So that's from that book. He followed that up 2 years later with a book called Hello Europe, Goodbye Chaos, Merkel's Migrant Bomb. And both of these books were reviewed on my Truth and Shadows by Barry Zwicker. So if anybody wants to know some more about that. Tonight he's going to be giving us a review of a new book called Eyes on Havana, Memoirs of an American Spy Betrayed by the CIA, by Vern Lyon, who's somebody he knows for a long time. And this book he reviewed for he wrote a review of. So that is something that you can check out as well. And basically, well, I'll let him talk about the book. I won't give any more introduction to that. I will pass it over to Mike.
All right, thank you. I really appreciate Craig McKee putting up my review of Vern's book on his website. I think that's fantastic. Let me ask you, how many people have read the the review on Truth and Shadows.
We might be muted.
I think everybody's unmuted now. Okay, go ahead. How many people have seen the advanced review on Truth and Shadows? Not many.
Okay.
But we have very few people on the call. We don't have as many people on the call as we had to start with. We're down to about a dozen.
Okay.
The 12 here. Yeah.
All right, well, then I can go and pretty much recap the review plus what I put up on Amazon. Names in my head. Vern Lyon was a good old all-American boy from the Midwest. He was raised to believe in God and motherhood and apple pie. And when he was in college at Iowa State University in the mid-60s, the CIA came to him and said, Vern, we got a deal for you. You can come to work for us on campus, and we'll guarantee you a job, a draft deferment, so you don't go get to Vietnam or get shot in some ice patch somewhere. We'll even offer you a job after graduation, and we'll give you a stipend, and you can spend however you wish. But we just ask a couple of things of you. We want you to report on your fellow students and professors and tell us what they think about the Vietnam War. And we kind of like to know because it's a big issue these days. Well, what happened was, this was fine and dandy. Vern didn't have to go to Vietnam to die in a rice paddy. And he figured it wasn't too much of a deal to report on his fellow students and professors because this was the American government. He trusted it to do the right thing. If the American government was doing this, well, obviously it was okay. And he kind of liked the pocket money. But as time went by, he was going to be an aerospace engineer, and he wanted to do that and not work for the Central Intelligence Agency. He wanted to work for McDonald's Aviation or something like this and be a productive member of the society doing what he was good at and doing what he had studied. So he told the CIA, well, thanks, but no thanks. I'll be happy to say goodbye to you, but if you ever need me, I'll be happy to help out. Well, he's working at McDonald's in St. Louis, and all of a sudden there's a mysterious explosion at the airport. And suddenly Vern Lyon is the man that the police are looking for. And the CIA comes to him and says, well, Vern, tell you what, you take your chances on hiring a lawyer and fighting this and keeping your security clearance, or you can come to work to us. We'd like to send you to Cuba, where you can make use of your aerospace background. The Cubans are big on cloud seeding, trying to get more crops out of the ground every year when it's a time of drought. And we kind of like to have you in there as an unofficial cover officer, somebody who's not attached to an embassy or a consulate, somebody who doesn't have a diplomatic passport, and somebody who goes to jail if they catch you. So Vern says, well, yeah, all right, I'll go. I don't seem to have much of a choice. Well, when he was there, he was collecting information. He was making contacts with diplomats, expatriates living in Cuba, and reporting back to Washington. And as time went by, the agency wanted him to do things like stop the flow of food to Havana and create shortages of food, just as is happening in Venezuela today. Well, he does this. He goes out and punctures tires of trucks hauling produce to Havana so that it's spoiled from traffic heat. And in one of the instances, he recounts in the book, he and his group of agents he had collected, found out that there was going to be an opening of a new school in the suburbs of Havana, and they were getting shipments of milk for a week. So he gets the guys to stop the truck, persuade the driver to get out and then look the other way for a while, and one of his dissidents dumps powdered cement into the school children's milk. And he didn't know whether anybody got sick from that, but at that point he said, I got sick of it. I thought I could do better. I thought this was a real bad news, and he wanted out. and he told the agency, I kind of like to resign. I've got a wife and I've got a child here. And I think that I'm no further use to you, and the information is drying up anyway. Well, not long after that, it turns out that the Cuban counterintelligence is on him. And they capture him, and they talk to him, and he's eventually allowed to leave the country, and he went to Canada. Went to Winnipeg and talked to the Royal Canadian Mounted Intelligence people about Cuban penetration of Canada. But the FBI somehow walked across the border and worked with the chief of police of Winnipeg to have him kidnapped and taken back to North Dakota, where he could go to trial for all his terrible sins. And that was foiled by an observant Mountie sergeant who listened to Vern talk about his lawyers and talk about you should call these people in the RCMP. And the guy turned his car around, drove back to Winnipeg, and the awful truth came out. And the Americans persuaded the Canadian government to ship him out, and he went to Lima, Peru, where he was kidnapped off the street and taken to the United States by U.S. Marshals, and he was tried and sentenced for the bombing of the airport, and he was given 17 years in Leavenworth. Eventually, he was paroled after 68 months, and found he couldn't get a job. He was a convicted felon. He was a second-class citizen now. He tried to get a job, and mysteriously, nobody would hire him. He ended up with a ministry dealing with the Latin community in Des Moines, Iowa. And every time he tried to get another job after that, somehow it all fell through. He never knew whether the three-letter agency was giving behind-the-scenes information to the prospective employer or not. But, you know, he was bumping along at the bottom with a limited income with a wife and a stepdaughter in the United States, having been forced to divorce the Cuban woman. So he's went to work for Vermeer, did some sales in Latin America for their construction equipment and agricultural equipment. He's now, I guess, 75 years old, and figured that it was time to write this book and tell what he'd went through, give some of his experiences. He didn't emphasize what happened to him after he got back to Iowa, after he got out of prison, and I got a lot of that from him and all the problems that he had with the employment. But he told me that the book is 200-odd pages. It says on the website 227, I guess. He said it was twice as long, but the McFarland, the Polish publisher, They cut out a lot of the Cuban information, a lot of the Canadian information, and a lot of the Peruvian information. He said he could have written another book just based on that. And he's thinking of a follow-up to his first book based on his experiences in Leavenworth and what he had to do to stay alive there. I would recommend you read his book. It's available from Amazon for about $30. They seem to have problems keeping it in stock, and I don't know what that is. I've seen information saying that McFarland had disputes in the past with Amazon wanting to cut their prices. So you wind up ordering it, and then they say, we'll send you an email when it ships. So I don't know what the problem is. But he's got good reviews on Amazon from some interesting people. We've got David McMichael, who had been a CIA analyst and U.S. Marine Corps captain. He said that it's an extraordinary autobiography of a disastrous relationship between the CIA and the operative they recruited and targeted and betrayed. The heart-wrenching tale deserves to be read. According to Yuri Tatrov, a former KGB colonel in counterintelligence, he said, Vern's story has so shocked me that I hope he will one day make it public. He's got a comment from James Everett, a former CIA non-official case officer in Scandinavia, who wrote his own book, The Making and Breaking of an American Spy. Jim had said, Vern Lyon is passionate about speaking truth to power. This book is of historical value. And he has a review from Peter Jenny, who wrote Mary's Mosaic about the assassination of Mary Pinchot Meyer, John Kennedy's lover. He said, what happened to Vern is a true American horror story, one of the CIA's most pitiful episodes and one that deserves to be told. So I urge you all to read it. Go read the reviews on Amazon. Read my review on Craig McKee's Truth and Shadow and form your own opinion. But I tell you, truth is not on the walls of the CIA. It's between the pages of Vern's book. And it's Eyes on Havana.
Wow.
Thank you very much for that succinct and informative review. Would anybody like to ask a question or make a comment? I guess we should probably go into – no, we can't go into Q&A because we can't unmute. So we'll have to do it openly here. Let me unmute Barbara here. I'm not sure why she's muted.
I just have a comment, Ken, if I can. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mike, is there a reason why you're urging people to go to Amazon as opposed to buying it somewhere else, since Amazon doesn't seem to be so reliable?
No, there's no reason. I don't know where it's in stock, whether you can buy it in a bookshop or not. I don't get too much information from McFarland's website.
Okay. Yes, yeah, so I would just say to go to, even Barnes & Noble will order things, rather than to go to Amazon if they're acting, you know, not so honest about the whole thing.
And you can go to McFarland's website. They're down in North Carolina. Maybe you can order directly from them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Can I make a comment, Gordon?
Go ahead, Gordon.
I was approached twice by the CIA to work for them.
Really?
I was on two presidential protective details, Eisenhower's and Kennedy's. And it's not unusual for us. We lived in a pre-Revolutionary War or Civil War building in the Naval Weapons Plant. We had our own little bar, and the CIA was under a cover. They wouldn't come and give you a CIA card. We'd try and recruit us because we had other clearance in the world. We'd been trained for presidential protection and all that. And so what he has been saying rings very true. This is this kind of crap they do all the time. So.
Okay. Well, there we have it from someone on the inside. And any other comments or questions? Anybody else want to make a comment or ask you a question? Just say your name.
This is Wayne. And I just want to just say that I really enjoy these informative reviews by people who have reviewed or read the books and talked to them. So I think it's something that we should continue on doing. So thanks, Michael. Over.
Right, especially people as authoritative as J. Michael Springman. Okay.
Exactly.
Any other comments or questions?
Craig.
Great. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Did you get a sense from the book? I don't know how much Vern just sort of sticks to his own story, or whether he puts anything in any kind of larger context. But I'm just kind of curious as to whether, you know, we have sort of indications, or if what seems to have been done to him is something that, you know, has other precedents, that somebody that maybe says, okay, I don't want to be part of this operation anymore, ends up being basically persecuted and sort of gone after in various ways, you know, to punish him for doing so. Is that something that, does he make any mention of that in the book?
No, not really. But I do know that from talking to Toto Constant, the Haitian CIA operative that was seen as a nasty bad boy, and talking to David McMichael, that this is a standard operating procedure for the agency. You use somebody, you use them for their intended purpose, like tissue paper, and you blow your nose into them and throw it away. Like Constant, he was perfectly fine with the agency until he decided he wasn't going to do it. He didn't like it. He was an embarrassment to them, and all of a sudden he was in the States, and he was under arrest for immigration violations, that kind of thing. And he's not the only one. There's who's the guy in North Africa and Libya who was working for the agency, and all of a sudden he was accused of drug running and gun running. I can't remember the guy's name right now. But Verna, I think, is typical of what the agency does. And McFarland Books is McFarlandBooks.com. And I think you can find books there and order them directly from them.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, don't forget Jonathan Marshall and his children and his dog.
Yeah.
Can I make one Philip. More comment?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just please, go ahead, Gordon.
Yeah. At Dulles Airport in March at that conference, I'm going to divulge something like 20 new pieces of information, more meat on the table. Two of them will be about what you're talking about right now, and very dramatic ones. I'll talk about what the CIA had done regarding, let's see, how can I word this? I'm going to come out to the details next month. One involves the fact that there was a CIA contract officer, if you're familiar with the jargon, who lived about a mile and a half away from Jackie's house, Jackie Kennedy, in Gladstone, New Jersey, for years. And I found him out, and I was curious, since I've guarded the Kennedys, you know, what the hell he was doing there, because he was involved in both the Biggs and the Kennedy assassination. And he had two associates who talked, and they got whacked. And he was in fear for his life. Mm-hmm. He was in fear for his life a mile and a half away from Jackie's house. So I was very conscious of that. So I'll be making a few revelations there. I won't go into more details on that. The second one had to do with a very major breaking thing that that I'm breaking, working with David Denton on, that I was going to show a film. I debriefed somebody recently, and while there's a little further editing that needs to be done, so I can't show it, but I can talk about it. I have permission to talk about it, where you will see what happened to a family of loyal Americans dedicated in every way, who in the end got sucked into the assassination, couldn't back out. The entire family was threatened with their lives if they did. One of the other people involved committed suicide, so on. So this is a wholesale, large-scale tragedy that's been going on for over half a century.
Yeah, by the way, for everybody to know, I will send to Cheryl and Ken the link to the conference website. It's March 9th, 10th, and 11th, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, at a hotel at Dulles Airport near D.C. And it will be live streamed for, I think, only $40.
Mm. Yes. Yay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Hi, this is Marie Spike. I have a question for Gordon.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You mentioned before that the CIA wanted you dead, but that you were too valuable. I'm wondering, you know, how safe are you now? And how safe are all the people who were involved in 9/11 truth?
I gave a talk to very high people in the aerospace defense industry at the Capitol Hilton. And it was just me talking and one and about 10 tables with about 8 chairs per table maybe. And about 4 months earlier, I was under surveillance thanks to Richard Helms. I was investigating on my own his assassination of material witnesses. And I got surveilled. So I arrived and went in to look at the seating arrangements to see who was sitting where. especially at the speaker's table. And there was one seat right across from me where there was no car there, but there was a setter. So we had cocktails and talked, and it was classified. And when I was a banker at the time. I wasn't working for the government. I got up to walk to the podium. I was in the speaker, and in walks Richard Helms. And he walked straight to that one seat. He didn't have a seat marker. And he's staring at me all the time. He stared at me through my presentation. I didn't duck his look. I knew what was going on. And when I finished, my talks are usually pretty dramatic. This one caused one of the treasurers of Lockheed Corporation to get fired. And I sat down, and he got up and left, and he never said a word to anybody in the building. Okay. So Richard Helms definitely needed me dead. The drug cartels needed me dead. I put all the Blackhawks into Columbia. I put all the Swift boats on the rivers with Venezuela, a lot of other things. And one of the cartels was trying to get me in Brazil. And the guy that I worked with, at that point I was working with California Microwave, he came down to meet me, and they tried to nail him to Bogota. And a senior guy in the Mossad told me, look, when you got to leave, he says, I've had 10 men telling you a week, and we can't protect them. Well, you got to get out of here. And he told me what happened to the guy I was supposed to meet. Well, I never had anybody to help me. He did. So I've heard a lot of people, a lot of bad guys, and they have a funny feeling. I've had death threats from three mafia families. I carry 2 .45 automatics. I'm still in a good loop. I'm going on 77.
Well...
Yeah, and by the way, I should let everybody know, Gordon wears black turtlenecks and looks a bit like, 007, just for the record.
Okay. So the answer is that you're...
I love getting the guys.
Okay, well, so the reality, you're not safe, and anyone else who really goes out on a limb and has a lot of information is not safe, so that...
I'll tell you something sad. I can't get anybody to debrief me. I've been rebuffed I'm certainly not going to go to the CIA or the FBI. But I tried going to Marine Corps Intelligence. And they, in a friendly way, politely, they closed the door on me. Nobody wants to debrief me. I know too much.
So it means that... there's really no protection for anyone who's a truth teller.
There is. And I'll tell you what I'm doing, and I'm going to try and recruit all of you to this. I am trying at the moment to convince a former commandant of the Marine Corps, because I think the Marine intelligence are the ones protecting Trump right now. I went up to Quantico, and they were in lockdown. There's fighting going on. It's just not reported. Within the intelligence community.
Mm-hmm.
But they're helpful, okay. And so I ended up writing a letter to Al Gray, which I wrote to him on Friday. I couldn't figure out from his administrative gal. He's in his 90s. He's still alive. Former commandant of the Marine Corps, former director of the Defense of the National Security Agency. Saying that there was a need to establish safe houses and a walk-in capability. That's what you called in the intelligence world. We need an ability for walk-ins where they and their evidence can be protected, because the normal institutions one would go to are all penetrated and corrupt.
Right.
Possible exception, Marine Corps intelligence.
Okay.
And I had breakfast a week ago with another Marine Corps general who's a double dipper, and he doesn't want to jeopardize having worked with the government and everything else, so he won't touch it. He ran away screaming, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Not all Marines are brave. Yeah. Anyway, we'll see if Al Gray still is spitting in his spittoons or whatever, but he was a director of California Microwave when I was there. In fact, I've got 4 annual reports here, and his name and mine are side by side. So I'm connected.
Okay, well, you know, I do want to jump in to answer the question. For someone like Gordon, and for obviously lesser extent myself, although similar category, the protection that you have is to tell as much as you can publicly as possible. Why knock you off if you've already done it?
You know who I'm alluding to that I'm going to talk about next week. And I have warned that person over and over again how much at risk they're at. And the only answer today is to go public.
Exactly.
And I have a newfound respect for WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, what he's done. Now I understand there's no place he could go with what he got. Yeah?
Right.
Yeah, why didn't you
I have to say good night to y'all.
Night, Mike.
Thank you,
okay,
Mike.
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Thanks for having me on.
Maria?
Thanks for coming on.
Maria? Is this Maria Spikes?
Maria Spike.
Yeah, did you want to make your announcement real quick before you go?
Oh, yeah. You probably are all familiar with this article I read yesterday in MinPress News. Because it's actually from 2016, but it was published yesterday, and the title is FEMA Investigator Claims World Trade Center Vault Contents Emptied Before Attack. Is everyone familiar with that?
Yes.
I read it after you alerted us to it, Maria.
Okay. That was it. I just wanted to share that in case
if
anyone was unaware of it.
Yeah. If you want to send the link to Craig, we could put it in the minutes for everybody's reference.
Okay, and I'll send the link to the JFK conference that Gordon will be speaking at, and there will be you can find out how to live stream, get the live stream from that. Okay, I hadn't read that before. The part that I wanted to shocked me was that this person's wife was killed, and he had to he's now in Argentina, and they're trying to extradite him.
Yes, that's a very well-known part of 9/11, and he's a real truth teller, and there was even, I think, a 60-minute segment to look up on his case.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Marie. Okay, so again, thank you to both of our truth tellers tonight, to Gordon and to Michael, and we're going to take a little time now for any other announcements. To share with the community before we sign off tonight. So does anybody else have an announcement they would like to share?
I have an update, Barb, on the legal group.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yep, please.
All right. Well, just everybody should know that the grand jury petition, which we're all waiting to be filed, with the federal court for the Southern District of New York, it is delayed slightly because we are trying to get both 9/11 survivors and 9/11 family members to sign a petition, and it takes some time. It will make it much, much stronger. So that's the reason this hasn't happened yet. It was going to happen, I think, the last day or so of January. It was delayed for that reason only. Okay? So I will let everybody know, even if it's not on a call to the 9/11 telecom list, to alert you as soon as we know when it will be filed. And there will be a press conference on the steps of the federal court building there in Federal Square in New York City the morning of the filing.
Thank you for that update.
Listen, wait.
Thank you.
William, go ahead.
Yeah, so I just want to announce that there's going to be a United Day of Action Against U.S. Wars at Home and Abroad by the U.S. Foreign Bases Conference. And it's going to be April 14th, 15th. You can see some more details at either 911tap.org in the events calendar or nobases.org. You can look, just Google that. And all calls, including 9/11, are welcome. on this march. So just to let everyone know, over.
Thank you. Okay. Very important.
Cheryl, do you want to say anything, Cheryl, about the plan for the Left Forum coming up in early?
Yeah, I can. It's just in the initial stages, but Kat and I were concerned that they might not accept us again this year at the Left Forum, so we submitted a panel with the people we thought were most likely to want to be on, and one was Kevin Jarrett. And anyway, they wound up approving the panel. And I had a long talk with Guy Marcus, who does a lot of the work for the Left Forum. And he said that this year they're doing it differently because he said they didn't handle it well last year, like, no kidding. And we kept pointing out, I think as you mentioned earlier, that their theme this year is, a lot of different voices and not squelching any voices within the left. And so we kept pushing that as we wrote that up in our proposal. Anyway, they've accepted the panel, and I talked to Marcus, and he said once they approve it, they're going to spend more time on approval and, vetting the people more closely. So once it's approved, they won't cancel it, is what he told me. So we'll see. If someone comes in and complains and calls people anti-Semitic or something, that I don't know if that will change them, but they're saying not right now that they won't change it. So so we're going to be doing a few more panels, and I can give them more of an update next month.
And what are the dates of the Left Forum?
I think it's June 1st through the 3rd.
Okay.
Let's see. Yeah, I think it's that, yeah.
And it will be
live
streamed.
Or it might be the 2nd
together.
Through the 4th. I'm sorry, I can't remember, but it's that first weekend in June.
Is No Life Radio going to live stream it again?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Good deal.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, speaking of Kevin Barrett, I would just like to make a quick announcement. I have finished reading Long Nose's masterpiece from Yahweh to Zion, and I cannot recommend the book highly enough. Whether you agree or disagree with the thesis he's presenting, it cannot be ignored. It's too masterfully presented to be ignored. You have to either be able to refute it or to agree with it. And I would just once again encourage everybody to spend the $30. You won't regret it. Believe me, this is a masterpiece. Okay.
Agreed. Agreed. Kevin translated it. Please name the book.
Kevin is the translator. Kevin translated it from French into English. Okay. So
please name the book.
Yeah. From Yahweh to Zion.
From Yahweh to Zion.
Mm-hmm.
And, Ken had mentioned earlier. Oh, go ahead.
I will try to put together a decent review of it for an upcoming teleconference. But I'm just so pressed for time, I haven't had the time to do it.
Thank you.
I will work on that because it's a book that deserves a complete critical review.
Okay, then I think as part of the final part of every call, we're going to have a short. Proposals for future guests. Is that correct?
Yes. That's correct.
Well, I'd like to propose Gordon coming back if he's willing to talk about the JFK assassination and the deep state. I think that would be a really important one to have if he's willing.
Gordon, would that be of interest to you?
That's what I'm doing with the rest of my life is trying to make use of what I know. After my book comes out, which focuses on these events, the book right behind it is on Wall Street and the financial crisis and the corruption of the money center banks in 17 different bear in mind that I've sat on every committee of the New York Clearinghouse. I've been a member of senior management of 2 U.S. and 1 Italian money center banks. I know everything that's going on. I knew Walter Wriston and John Reed at Citicorp. I know how they tie into Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and Barney Franks and the rest of them. And I want to take them all down.
Well, I certainly.
Are you saying that you'd like to wait until your book comes out to be on the call again, or what?
No. I'm going to wait for the session.
Okay. All right. So that sounds like a yes to me.
Thank you,
Barbara. Thank you, Gordon.
When you tell the truth, the best you know it. It's not hard to talk.
All right. Well, that I think this is an encore performance that everyone will welcome. Is there any objection to inviting Gordon to the next call? Okay, so hearing none, then he will definitely be central to our next teleconference. Any other suggestions for upcoming teleconference people we might reach out to?
This is Wayne. I think one of the people that might be interesting to interview is Sander Hicks. He's running for Congress in Manhattan, and he's been traveling around the country. Not quite barnstorming, I guess, but I think he would be a very interesting person to have on the call talking about the political aspects of it. Over.
Sure. Would you care to reach out to him and see if he'd be willing?
Yes, I'll do that. Thank you.
Okay. All right, thanks. Yeah. That's a great suggestion, too.
And I'd like to recommend, not for next time's call, because Gordon will be a major guest on that, on the Deep State. But for a future call, it would be with Francis Gregory Ford. I think I've mentioned him to you before. I will send again the link to the interview on YouTube I did with him. It's audio only. You have our photographs on it. But he is a major 9/11 witness, to the foreknowledge and planning involving the CIA, the FBI, and Able Danger.
Barbara,
so,
do you want to try and line him up for, April?
Mm-hmm.
What date would that be?
Wednesday of April.
The last Wednesday.
Yeah, what's the date?
Oh.
Let me look. I have a calendar here, just a minute.
And we might as well tell Gordon what the date for next time's call would be, too.
Well, the next call would be the same date. It would be March 28th.
Yep, it's Wednesday, March 28th.
March 28th. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then April is April 25th.
April 25th, that should be fine. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I will ask him for April 25th, if that's what you're saying.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, I'll ask I'll ask Gregory, they both begin with a G. Gregory Ford for April.
Mm-hmm.
Great, thank you. Yeah, that'd be wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Barbara. Okay, well, some great suggestions there. Anything else? Anybody else have any ideas for future teleconferences that we could be reaching out to in the meantime, or they could?
This is Lynn Bradbury.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if anyone thinks it's too far afield to invite Allison Weir of If Americans Knew, or is
absolutely
everybody already
not
familiar?
Absolutely not. Are you familiar
great
enough with her to be able to reach out to her?
I think so.
Okay.
So I'll do that,
and maybe suggest
and get back to Cheryl.
That. Yeah, get back
if
to Cheryl. Maybe
a,
suggest. Mm-hmm.
Allison Weir's partner at CNI Online is Phil Giraldi. Also, be an interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Really? You mean at the same time or differently?
Well, it could be either. I mean, certainly in If Americans Knew, but even Phil, I hope, be again this year at the conference in the National Press Club all day the second. But he was a speaker the first of those, the now five conferences. But last year he was there, and he wasn't selling books, so it looked as though he was just giving them away to get them out.
I think it would be great to have them both on the same call.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. What was the conference that he was at?
This is, if you go to WRMEA.org, or that's the Linda Handling Company. If you go to IRMEP, it's Grant Smith. Grant and I are on speaking terms, but Delinda's a delightful person. Go to WRMEA.org and click on the conference button at the top, and not only will you get the plan for the current one, it's got Gideon Levy on it speaking, and this is at least the third time he's spoken. But he's really interesting. One of the really good guys who was speaking dropped out. Someone pressured him too hard. He'd worked for AIPAC for years, but he'd also worked for many people in Congress for years. And he's, well, anyway, he doesn't pull any punches either. But
could you give that website slowly again? WR.
It's Washington Report for Middle East Affairs. WRMEA.org. And somewhere near the top there'll be conference something. You click on it, and then you can. All the other stuff are up there, all the previous videos. Sometimes C-SPAN was there. Sometimes C-SPAN's been arm-twisted to not go there. Hamouk and I tried to get steal copies of the first conference, and Grant Smith had filed the first strike Hamouk ever had on YouTube, and that created a brouhaha. I sent the private. I sent email addresses for Allison Weir to Hamook and vice versa, and said they needed to meet. They met, and they've been good friends ever since. And the rest is history. He shot lots of videos over and things like that.
And when is the conference?
What?
When's the conference?
It's the second. It's you know, day after tomorrow.
Oh.
So who's speaking right now? Sorry.
I will be
Barton
there.
Barton Bruce.
Oh, Barton.
Bruce. Yeah. Yeah.
Barton, do you know Allison?
Well, I've shot videos with it, you know, of her. Hamook and I shot, we're trying to do three in one day here in the Boston area. And for technical reasons or all kinds of other reasons, none of them produced anything that was really worthwhile, although some of them are interested in just watching if you want to look at the snips. But we had hum from a PA system we were tapping in, doing one problem after another, and somebody turned the lights down so low you couldn't get anything in. A huge thing where almost the, it wasn't Muslims, but it was people who were all Semitic in the room, pretty much all Semitic. And that some guy bought every book that Allison had brought and was handing, you know, away her latest $10 book, which is really good. I'm just handing them out for free. And
oh.
It's just, but they turned the lights down low so that we just didn't get any good pictures.
So Barton, she knows, she's met you. I mean, if you would like,
she's met me, but her the lady who she lives with when she's in the Boston area in Natick is a PhD in theology who discovered that she was made a whore by having her husband divorce her. But as a religious scholar, she went to the local Catholic Church in Massachusetts and got nowhere, so she went to the Vatican filing a scholarly paper saying that this is a little bit wrong. And Vatican agreed with her but never told her. It was years later she discovered that she was no longer a whore in the church's eyes.
Who was that woman?
It's Jan, and I can't think of her last name, but she's the place where Allison stays when she's in the Boston area. But
okay,
both Jan and Allison left when I was pushing a little too hard on there were nobody killed at marathon bombing. That was those stump legs with bones sticking out were stage legs on a guy, and they were tired and upset. We'd taken them out to dinner, four of us from Boston, 9/11 Truth, you know. The other person that a lot of you might know is Bill Wilt, but the other two people were not people you'd know. But it was four of us from Boston 9/11 Truth who had taken them out in the Natick Framingham area to dinner late at night. And it sort of ended the dinner was over anyway, but they were tired and exhausted and exasperated with me pushing too hard. So.
Okay, so would you prefer I ask her? I was going to say if you know her,
you should ask her, Lynn.
We could get.
We were just emailing. She doesn't know me, but she was, you know, on that tour looking for more places to speak. And
yeah, but Hamook can ask her, especially if all kinds of people who can.
Right,
ask.
We can all urge. Her.
And I can nudge Phil Giraldi. I mean, you know, not
great.
That it's going to do any good, but it's
and what,
why not?
And what should we give them an idea of when?
Well, if we have Gordon next month and possibly Sander, then I would say, and then we're going to see about Francis Gregory Ford for next month.
Like the end of June, maybe.
Or
well,
maybe they could do April and we could move Francis to the next
month.
Yeah,
well, let's just see who we can get for
April.
Yeah,
that's fine. Yeah, Greg doesn't have to be in April.
Yeah.
Right, and
yeah.
We'll see what's good for them.
Yeah.
Say we're somewhat flexible and sometime before July, probably.
Right.
Okay.
Sounds
and
great.
We get back to you and Cheryl, Ken and Cheryl?
To me.
Cheryl.
To me.
Cheryl.
Okay.
One person
so you're talking about, you said April for them?
We don't know exactly when.
If they could do April, that would be great. If they can't, we can do another.
Okay.
This is the pair of them, but just getting Phil Giraldi himself, it might be interesting too.
Even one,
absolutely.
He's a history PhD, and he was what 17 years or something, boots on the ground in Europe, and he was I think a station chief. He speaks.
So what do you want
so
to invite
European.
Him first? I mean, do you know him?
Well, I've talked to him over the years, but as he puts it, he talks to anybody. Anybody who calls, he will talk to. We've had relatively small number of conversations, but some of them were about really touchy subjects. And,
so
okay.
I think what would be, first ask them if they're willing to speak, and then let them know we'll get back to them maybe with a date.
Well, is it better for him to recognize somebody's name is my question.
My hope is even if he's not there in the ante room there where they sell books and things, if he didn't get allowed to do that, the people running it are very touchy about 9/11, and I can't talk now, but I may know some of the reasons why. It's not Delinda Hanley's side of the thing.
For both Philip and Allison, whoever calls them, let them know that it's always the last Wednesday of the month, and which month would work for them or months, and get
right
to Cheryl and Ken, and they can coordinate.
Sure.
Even if Phil is not there as a book in the ante room, he will most likely be there in the audience. I've seen him there in the audience times when he wasn't doing anything else. But he was one of the speakers, as was Ray McGovern and everybody else you can think of the first year. But they had so many people, nobody could get any length of time, so they've been hacking it shorter and shorter, less people every year, so they can give them a decent amount of time. But
well,
all their videos are online, and they're really good. I mean, they're worth listening to. Look at the speaker lists for all of those. And if you go to that WRMEA thing, look at the conference, and then when you get it there, you'll find the previous conferences. You click there, and you'll find that they're all available on YouTube now.
Well,
is the one coming up going to be live streamed, do you know?
No. Well, unless C-SPAN shows up. I don't think they're live streaming from the press club. They were planning to make money with DVDs originally, and then they discovered that they don't really make money. So they do make DVDs, and they do sell them. But last year, you know, you got in the bag you get when you go in. They give you some things, little things to carry.
Okay, do we understand
they
correctly,
gave away
Barton?
DVDs to everybody who came, yeah?
So do we understand correctly, Barton, that you're going to this conference and we'll just ask Philip Girardi?
I got one of the early sign-on
tickets
where it's $79.
So just ask Philip Girardi, and if Allison's there, ask her. If you're physically there.
She may not be there. Phil's more apt to be there, I think, but I could be wrong.
Well,
okay,
I'll email her right away and see if she can also be on the same one as he is.
But they may have their own reasons to be or not to be together. I mean, you know.
Okay.
So we'll give them the option of together or alone.
I mean,
right.
All right. So you're going to be with Phil, hopefully, and you can just ask him. Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
Right. Okay.
And I'll email Allison.
Yes.
All right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, they're very good people. That's good teamwork, and hopefully we'll be looking forward to some really good teleconferences in the future based on everybody's efforts.
And this was great.
So,
and.
Yes,
and
very,
Ken,
very
Ken?
Well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Craig.
I was just thinking I might try again with William Pepper because he we're coming up to the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's assassination. And, of course,
that's what
we had talked about before, that it would be a great thing to have him on to talk about his latest book on the subject. And it couldn't be more perfect for the timing. So I could reach out to him and see if he's willing to do that.
And I also want to just remind people that as soon as the grand jury petition is filed, it will be on the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 Inquiry website. Everybody can read it. It's already 50 pages plus a whole ton of exhibits that go on for like a stack of 3 inches.
Oh, you can read it already.
I'm sorry, what?
You can read it already.
No, you can't.
Oh, okay. Okay, sorry.
Are you asking or telling me?
Yes, I'm asking.
No. Once it's filed, which it isn't yet, it will be on the Lawyers Committee for 9/11 website. I'm a member of the Grand Jury Petition Research and Drafting Committee, so I've read it. But I had to sign a non-disclosure agreement to even be on the committee. So it's closely held until it's filed. But my point is, once it's filed, and I will let you know in advance, because I will know in advance, at least shortly in advance, when it will be filed and when it will be online. And once it's filed and online and we have a chance to read it, and it will blow your mind, it's so strong, then my recommendation would be to ask Mick Harrison and or Jane Clark, ideally Mick, because he's the main drafter or author, to be on the call. But we just don't know which call that would be yet.
Yeah. We have to play that one by ear.
Okay. All right, that's it.
Okay, thank you, Barbara. Okay, so great work, everybody, and super call, and
I guess that's it for tonight, so we'll see you all March 28th for the next 9/11 and other Deep State Crimes teleconference, okay? Have a great
day.
Thank you, Gordon.
Thank you, Gordon.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Thanks, Gordon.
Thanks a lot.
And Michael. Uh-huh.
And Michael.
Yeah.
Okay.
Good night.
Okay, I'm going to turn the recording off.
I'm just trying to get back online here. My computer failed, so I'm just getting back online.
I think. Want me to try turning it off? Let's see.
Yeah.